Okay, you're on, Martha.
Good evening from the Washington Center of the University of California. And I see that we do have a full house there back in Towson. And welcome to what is a cooperative venture here between the Washington Center of the University of California and Towson University and the Political Science Department. It is a pleasure to get together the two schools and to work on a subject that is of interest to students, I think, in a large number of places. The subject of White House communications, the way in which a White House is organized, and the ways in which a White House uses the news media as a resource, and the discussion of the relationship between the White House and the press. It is an important relationship to study, not only because it is an interesting one and involves the president, but it's important for us as citizens for what we know about our government. And we are interested in the president, what he is thinking, what he is doing, because he is so important as an initiator in our political system. As we pull together our course, I'd like to thank Larry Berman, who is the director of the Washington Center, who is very creative in figuring out ways to make this work. Roger Brack, who is the information technology person who was working wonders here, and to Polly Adams at Towson, who is doing the same there. It's a pleasure to work with you, and I'm looking forward to our discussions. The way that we're using this course is to look at the subject of White House communications from a different angle than we normally do. We're going to look at it from the perspective of officials and reporters, those who are involved in the relationship. And we want to look at how they see each other, how they use each other, what kinds of information policies they work on, how they see their own jobs, and how they see the jobs of the other side, sometimes the adversary in their relationship. And over the course of the period from now through today, we're going to be speaking with several people who work in the White House and have worked in White Houses, including Dan Bartlett, the White House Communications Director, Scott McClellan, Press Secretary, Mike McCurry, who was the Press Secretary under President Clinton from 1995 to 1998. We're going to speak with reporters, Helen Thomas, who is the Dean of the White House Press Corps, and Fran Lewin, who had worked at Associated Press at the time that, that Helen was working at United Press International. They both were covering Bess Truman and Mamie Eisenhower, and then went to the West Wing to cover President Kennedy. And Helen Thomas is still at the White House. In fact, today she was asking a lot of questions of the press secretary about weapons of mass destruction and intelligence information. We will speak also with Bill Plant from CBS, Alexis Simondinger from National Journal will be coming into the classroom in Towson, and so will April Ryan of American Urban Radio Network. She too will be coming into class there. We'll speak with Mark Orchard, who is a BBC correspondent, who is going to talk to us about Tony Blair's operation in addition to looking at the White House operation. And we will talk to Bob Deans of Cox Newspaper about covering foreign policy from a White House angle. He was the past president of the White House Correspondents Association, and will also speak with the current president, Carl Cannon, who is with National Journal and the White House Correspondent. So we have a lot of interesting people to talk to on both sides, and we have the course outline, and for any of you who are not part of the course, who would like the course outline, we would be happy to send it to you. You can get the address, you'll be able to get my address from the website from the Washington Center of the University of California. The course is being brought in part through a grant by the University System of Maryland, a Wilson H. Pelkins professorship that I received for 2003-2004. And the idea was to develop information on White House communications and then use that information in a course. And I've been working on developing a database of presidential press conferences, and you all will be able to get some of that information. We'll talk to people, the reporters and officials about press conferences, and when I'm back at Towson lecturing, I will give you information about that. The way we'll work the course is we're going to have conversations here, and then after we finish, then Professor Corsi will speak with you about the sessions and the ways in which they work together with the readings that you have been doing. Tonight, our first session, we are going to start with an historian, William Seale, who knows more about the White House and has written more about it than I think than anybody that we know. You are the expert on the White House, the architecture of the White House, but also way beyond that. In his book, two-volume work, The President's House, which is a beautifully written book in addition to having so much information in it, is very good in bringing together the context of the White House with the political and social ties that are reflected in the White House and its furnishing. So William and I are going to be talking about the White House as a building and as a symbol, and then we will talk some about staff and about publicity operations over the years. Dr. Seale has his PhD and his master's degree from Duke University. He has worked as an advisor to the White House and the Smithsonian Institution, and he is the editor of White House History, a journal, a very interesting journal that is published by the White House Historical Association. When looking at the White House, what was the idea in its creation of it as a symbol? You know, today, when their visiting heads of state come to Washington, and they want it to be photographed with the president at the White House. It is a very important symbol for them. For example, I've been looking at press conferences and trying to figure out why do we now have so many joint press conferences. And one of the reasons is that visiting heads of state want that photo with the president, with the White House as a background. It is a very important symbol for us domestically, but now worldwide. When the White House was created, the thinking that went into it, was it important? Was it to be important as a symbol? Were they thinking of it as simply the House of the President? What were the ideas, and who discussed them?
Well, in the provided for in the Constitution, and the president, the House would be provided for the president, and the Capitol would be provided. It wasn't specified that it would be a symbolic house. It was inevitable. And George Washington, being the president, took this under his wing and set out to build something far greater than what is here now. And, you know, he ordered the city laid out and everything. And so he was very aware of the symbolism of it all. And it was built, you know, on a scale of grandeur, far grander than anything in the United States. We've lost sight of that with everything so much bigger now. But it was a vast, vast house, and it was built to be a great communicator from the start. Everyone who's lived there has used it that way. It's inevitable. And of course, today, with press and communication being what it is, this is magnified. But you can go back to the earliest days and find the same. And Washington's own concern that it be important enough for people, foreign visitors, and people to say that's where the president lives. But it was the Congress who specified that the president lived in a specified house. And that probably is its descent from kingship, because there are certain little traces of that in the presidency anyway, and a king in a palace.
And tell us about how the plans were developed. Was Congress involved beyond funding? Were they involved at all with the
Congress had nothing to do with it, funding. It was taken under George Washington's wing, and he personally handled and managed everything. And he was a very rational, sensible man. You know, he had never traveled outside of North American continent. He had been once to the West Indies with his brother, who's dying, to get citrus and so forth. But he had never traveled. He had seen pictures and books. And he wanted something on a level with what people of importance lived in England primarily. And that's what he got. He got a Georgian house built by an Irish builder. No, the Congress had not a word to say about it, except to complain. See, it was communicating a lot of things from the start. The second floor wasn't up, but the Congress was raising Cain about it, about how expensive it was and how big it was. Who could ever live in anything? It was bigger than 10 churches. Who could ever live in anything like that? So it had already was well underway with its communication before it was finished.
Did they have any impact? You said that he had a grander idea when he began.
He thought big, and he had a French engineer who was a veteran, wounded in the Revolutionary War, Pierre Charles L'Enfant, who designed the city for him. Of course, Jefferson opposed it, Madison opposed it, Washington wanted a big city like in Europe. And L'Enfant set it out, and he set out big buildings in it. We don't have the drawings for what L'Enfant wanted for the White House, but we do know that it was to fill the crisscross between New York Avenue and Pennsylvania Avenue, had they been extended and crossed. So you can measure that, and you can see that it was a huge house, five times the size of what was ever built, and by L'Enfant's own admission, 25 feet taller. It was huge. Washington approved that, and the cellars were all dug for it. And then they had a run-in with L'Enfant because he couldn't get used to the committee system of the new nation. He thought it was Washington was a king, you know. So he had to be fired. And they went back to committees, and they kind of badgered George Washington down to the smaller house, which was still the biggest house in the country until it was probably right after the Civil War.
Who was on the committee? What was the committee composed of?
Well, first it was Friends of Washington. Gentlemen, he called them. They didn't get any fees. They came in. That didn't work at all. He couldn't control them really. Oh, they'd have a sick horse and wouldn't come to the meeting. So he got rid of them after about 2 years and appointed a committee that was paid, a commission that was paid. And they met here and they met regularly and they attended to the business. And they hired practical people. The buildings here, White House was built by people from all over the world, but mainly Scots, Scotland, two parts of Scotland, Highlands and Edinburgh. And they came here and did all the carving, which I'll show you a picture of later, and the unusual things about the house. And then many of them went back home. I found them, strangely, through the Masonic records of the Arkwright Masons in Edinburgh. They had all their little notebooks and the names attached to them. See, every Mason who would do a bit of work would cut his symbol into the stone. So President Truman, when the house was remodeled, removed all those stones and sent one to every Masonic chapter in the United States and Mexico. So I wrote them, and they sent rubbings and pictures and everything. So those we took to Scotland and went into the Masonic records and were able to connect these actual workmen and who they were and where they were from there. They were all top of the line. They were all top of the line people. And when war broke out between England and France, there was a moratorium on building. And these men were like speculators, real estate speculators. They'd build a house and then sell it. They were all invested up to their nose, and they fled illegally. They left and came to the New World, answering an ad to build the Capitol and the White House.
So was the ad run in papers throughout the world?
London, Paris, and they got in trouble in Paris. They thought they were encouraging people to immigrate. And then they got then Edinburgh and Dublin.
So they found that they just didn't have the grasp here.
Oh, they didn't. And the few that they had wanted to stay in the city. So boom, Philadelphia just exploded in New York too. They didn't want to leave. They had a lot of work. They wanted to get them over here, and they weren't very nice to them when they were here. It's an interesting story because it's on the edge between being paid by the job, like a contractor or a freelancer, or being paid by the hour. And the commission wanted to pay them by the hour and make them check in and punch the clock, so to speak. And they didn't want to do it. So there was trouble the whole time. But it got built largely, I think, because of the personality of George Washington. He was worshipped. He was worshipped all over the world, even in England. He's considered the greatest living individual. And And I think they wanted his house finished.
In the commission, did the commission work through a lot of compromising?
Oh, yes.
And who did they have to compromise?
Washington, until he was out of office. Then they could push Adams around, second president. But Washington, who ironically is the only one who never lived in the house, was the one they had to deal with. And when they cut the scale of the house down to a fifth, he went to the meeting and he was a little sore about it. So he made them double the amount of ornamentation on it and other things like that. So we'll see. And
how much did Washington see before he died?
It wasn't finished, but he could stand in Lafayette Park today and he would know it. You'd have to squint a little bit. It's the same house.
Would you like to take us through?
Yes, I'd love to. I brought some slides to, you know, I don't know where a camera is in this newfangled bag. Is that the camera?
Yes.
I don't think. Well, I brought some slides to sort of run through the story of the White House rather quickly, so we don't have much time. But we can have the first one. This is the first and only state portrait ever commissioned in American history. And it's a copy, in fact, of one commissioned by Lord Lansdowne, the Earl of Lansdowne in England, of George Washington after the American Revolution. And the federal government had a copy made of it, which hangs today in the White House. This shows the first president as people thought of him, as a king. It's like a royal portrait. This is the facade of the White House that you know very well. It could be in any postcard you send from anywhere. Next.
In this facade, people often think of this as the front of the house.
It is the business front.
Uh-huh.
This side was considered for business and the back side was considered for family. This portico or porch was added on in 1829. It was not part of the original house. The house had no front porch, as you'll see from other drawings. There's the original drawing of the front of the house by James Hobart. He was an Irish immigrant, a builder, very well trained in Dublin, and he came and worked in Philadelphia and then in Charleston, South Carolina. And when L'Enfant had to go, Washington was going on his southern tour, and he was introduced to him by people he liked, and a year later remembered him and brought him up to Washington and put him in charge and always had a lot of faith in him. And he knew how to deal with his clients, unlike L'Enfant. He designed a house that an English squire would have lived in the country, which Washington decided that was appropriate for an American president. See, it had 85 acres around it. It was going to be sort of a farm.
Had Washington seen any of his work?
I have to speculate on it. I think he saw the old courthouse in Charleston meeting in Broad because it looked very much like this house. And that sounds just like Washington, you know. And then there was a portico I think he had built that Washington had breakfast on. I can't prove it. No one wrote it down. Here's the original plan. That drawing has been restored, you'll be glad to know, but I always liked it with the hole in it up at the top. That's the entrance hall. It's the same plan exactly today when you go there. This oval room at the bottom is the blue room, and this room over here to your left is the east room. And there they are, and that's the size they were and everything. It was originally a back porch, like Mount Vernon, and strangely enough, the White House is a place that changes all the time and in some ways never changes at all. All the doors to that porch are still cut, but they had the doors cut and the stone cutters had left and the porch wasn't built. So it's still there with little wooden windows in the bottom. But this is the same house as designed. One thing interesting about it is the original Leinster house that is patterned on in Dublin was a much more complex house with ante rooms for all the ceremonial living. Washington had this simplified like an American house. They're not secret stairs and antechambers and places for stewards and things. It's a pretty much wide open plan for the time.
What did he think were the essentials of the house, of the president's house?
Well, the East Room, for example, in those days the Congress brought bills to the president, and the East Room was for that purpose. The Congress was to come in person and present the bills to the president. And that sort of thing. The Oval Room was there for a reason, because when the president received men callers, they came by, they had to apply, and then they were admitted on Thursdays at the levee. They came and stood in a circle, or an oval, and he was at the head of the oval, and he went around and spoke to everyone. And when he moved to his temporary house in Philadelphia, he knocked out the back wall of the room and put a bow in. So I'm sure that Oval Blue Room is what he had in mind. It was never to be. It was not really used that way. But, you know, he thought there'd be a zone for private living and a zone for ceremony and state ceremony, which he thought was very, very necessary to define the presidency as different from everybody else, even if it was elected. He would go to an entertainment as a private person and let it be known, and then he'd shake hands. But if he went as president, he did not shake hands. In fact, he carried a fake hat and put his hand on the dress sword so no one would try. It was experimental years. Now, at the beginning, you didn't know. This is over the front door. And if you ever go to the White House, the tour takes you out this way, and nobody ever looks. But it's one of the most magnificent piece of carving ever done in the United States, in America, before the 19th century. That garland up at the top is 14 feet long, cut into stone, cut out of Aquia Creek down in the Potomac. The flowers, the old Scotch just went crazy. Because it was all terribly out of style for them, because the simple classicism was in. But Washington liked his ornament, and they said, okay, and they knew how to do it, because they had learned as apprentices. And then this is what they did. A period of 10 years was taken to clean all this and conserve it. So it all is now conserved with paint. It had 42 layers of paint on it. Originally, it was whitewashed by the Scots, and that was the hardest coat to remove.
Did Washington design? Did he have a role in designing that?
I don't know. He approved it, is all I can say, because they wouldn't have dared do it without him. And he loved it. And it is funny that you should ask that, because at Mount Vernon in the mantelpieces, a lot of this ornament was already there. And I can just imagine Hovind saying, well, we can do this, you know. It's Washington, you know. This guilloche, as it's called, this Grecian chain under the window, that's under a window, and it's shown without any paint on it. That appears all over the house. It's in the mantelpiece in his office in Mount Vernon.
Uh-huh.
It's a beautiful job of stonework. The stone isn't worked. It's pretty bad. And the Scots whitewashed it to keep it from getting rain in it and cracking when it froze. So they put this heavy coat of whitewash on it, and you see traces of it. It's almost impossible to remove.
Where did the stone come from?
Aquia Creek, which is below Mount Vernon, was not owned by Washington, as some books have said. It was below Mount Vernon's own, it had been a quarry established by a woman named Margaret Brent in 1699, and it still produced this stone, and the government bought the quarry. And then they began running out, and they bought Seneca up the river in Maryland, which was this light stone to begin with, and it started again turning out this dark stone, which the Smithsonian's built out. This is the first published view of the house, the first graphics of the house, drawn about 1805 and published in 1807. So you see what it looked like originally. There's no porch. You see the blank over the front door, above the front door, and then there's a blank. Well, that was to have the American Eagles and all. It never had any of that.
Did Washington plan that the public would be coming through the house?
No, that's Jefferson. Good question. That was Jefferson entirely. Jefferson, and it's not as democratic as it sounds. In Europe, all stately houses were open to the public. At certain times, anybody could go in that was clean, you know. And they'd go in and look at the big public rooms, the state rooms. Jefferson opened the house in 1801 in April because he had gone through stately houses in Europe and he wanted the public to be able to do that. That's how he saw them in near Europe, you know, all the Madame du Barry's house and all those places. He would never have had access to that. But it was open to the public part of the day. And so that started in 1801, and except in wartime, it's been continued. And now, recent history, it's $1.5 million a year if you go through that house. This is the house, you know, it burned 22nd of August, 1814. The British burned it during the War of 1812 and the invasion of the United States, where the British moved from the shore up through Maryland, and a group of sailors came up the Potomac and burned this house down. The Madisons fled, and Madison ordered the picture of George Washington taken down. And she was more scared for herself because of the General Coburn had said he was going to take her to London and make her march in chains behind his carriage. But anyway, they burned the house. The same man who was the fire expert of Wellington in Spain was there, Lieutenant Pratt, Richard Pratt. And he devised it. It was very ceremonial. They went in and prepared it for hours, piling up the furniture and putting lamp oil on mattresses. And then they had javelins all around that were flaming. And they fired a shot and they threw them in the windows and the place blew up. And burned until the rain came, stopped it. So that's what was left after the fire. It was soon reconstructed. And it was reconstructed quickly. And this is an old painting by the French minister's wife, of the finished house looking from the back. You see how rough it is all around it? And they put the wings on each side were built by Jefferson. And here on the left, where one day the West Wing would be, it would be much talked about in this course. And it's a pretty authentic picture. It turned up in France, just parenthetically. You see the horse? Mm-hmm. To the right of the horse, you see the hole in the bank?
Yeah.
That's where the water closets, the toilets emptied from the second floor. Jefferson had water closets put in, and they just emptied right out in the road. It was strange to see that. I knew it from the documents because they had said this is what they did, but I first saw a picture of it, and I'm not sure the lady knew what that was.
How much of the White House today, of the exterior of the White House, has remained?
All of the stone walls are still there, thanks to President Truman.
And then you do see burn marks.
Oh, yes, when the paint's taken off. Yeah. This is the house finished finally in 1833. Everything's done. Staircases, everything's finished. In the administration of Andrew Jackson, English print, 1933.
How was the house viewed by the public? Was it well known?
It was already a White House by 1806. Uh-huh. It was so big and so white, the White House. Uh-huh. And they got to go there the 4th of July and New Year's Day. Anyone could go, and they did, and there was reception. And then it was open, of course, every day. And then in Jefferson's time, he took the treasures that were brought back by Lewis and Clark and Pike and all and put them in the entrance hall like a museum. So the public went there, even two little bears that were brought back. And he, so it was very much open to the public. People went there all the time. But remember, there weren't any trains, and Washington was pretty isolated, 400 miles from the ocean.
It wasn't regarded as excessive?
No. That'll be later, when they began putting fancy furnishings and things like that. It was still, in Jefferson's time in the 1820s, it was still pretty much General Washington's house. He was sacred. I just threw in a few history pictures. Here's one of the 30-day presidency of William Henry Harrison, the great hero of the Old Northwest. He got the chill at his inaugural speech, which was a mere 2.5 hours long, and it was freezing, and he caught pneumonia and died. There he is, the first to die in the White House. Not the first to die. Actually, the first to die in the White House was a little child who was a slave child, 3 months old, belonged to Jefferson. Next. Here's the house during the time of the American War with Mexico, 1846-48. You see the general areas becoming more civilized. The house is big. It's still huge. If we could go there and look at drawings and things, all that circle you see in front of it was all fenced away. There was plenty of security there. It was all fenced away. Here you see it a little better. This is the house Abraham Lincoln first saw as president, coming home from his inaugural. That statue is in the front yard because James K. Polk, after the Mexican War, wanted to be identified with Jefferson. Jefferson brought in Louisiana. He wanted to bring in, you know, California and all. And his wife thought it was so silly that she hung a portrait of Cortez in the blue room, showing that he was the conquistador. That picture is still out in Tennessee in the Polk Museum. So here's the house in all its mighty hope, the windows open, that never will happen again. And you see the swag over the door. This is 1861. And those trees had been planted for security. Security was always an issue at the White House. As early as Washington, he always had a close friend with him, and they were always armed wherever he went. James Monroe used to put sharpshooters around behind the balustrade up at the roof because of the fear of problems, because Europe was besought with that trouble. And in Lincoln's time, the window over the front door began to be the place where the president addressed the public, because people would come serenading. And with railroads, Washington was getting more people, and they would come call him out at night by torchlight, and he'd make a talk. Sometimes it was funny, depending on what the era, what that occasion was. And in Franklin Pierce's time, there were threats of assassination. And so they devised and built a little corridor upstairs, and the president would stand in that window with candles all around the window, and he'd make his speech because they could knock him to the floor if there was any disturbance. Well, Lincoln made his speeches from that window, and you'll remember after Appomattox, the Marine Band, which has played at the White House since 1800, they were gathered in front of the front door, and he said, I feel that we've, I forget the language, it was great, we've won the song Dixie at war, And now I will appreciate if the band will play. The band began to play Dixie. And the assassin, John Wilkes Booth, supposedly turned to the man next to him and said, "That's the last speech he'll ever make." It was two nights before the assassination. That statue was removed in 1873, and it's in Statuary Hall now.
How often would a president speak?
All the time. When the Congress was in session, a lot. Andrew Johnson spoke about every week.
And who would come?
Oh, sometimes 1,000, 1,500 people with torches, a lot of little drinks and under their belt. And they'd come usually singing. The only hostile one I ever read about or found out about was John Tyler. And they called him out and burned him in effigy from a tree. But usually it was friendly. Yes, he switched parties. But it was, they'd come from the taverns and things and march down the street singing and carrying on. And sometimes they'd get invited in, but not much. This is the funeral of Elmer Ellsworth in the East Room. It's the first Union casualty of note, which he was shot over on King Street in Alexandria, Virginia, right in front of what is now the Holiday Inn, pulling down a Confederate flag. He was a member of the Lincoln household. He roomed with his son Robert on the second floor, and he was a gymnast, a fireman gymnast from New York. And he was killed, and they brought him here. And I thought Martha would be interested in this, because this is the equivalent of a news photographer that did this picture. He is a William Waud. Oh, what an artist. It's a shame he didn't continue. He's in the same ilk as Winslow Homer that did the drawings for the newspapers during the Civil War. He did this drawing of Elmer Ellsworth's funeral and the Lincoln family there in the East Room of the White House.
What did people see? Say somebody in Tennessee, what would they know of what the White House looked like?
Well, there were drawings of it. They would have seen drawings before the photograph. Or if they ever went there, which not a lot of people did, they saw it. It never had the symbolic power that it was to gain in the Civil War. Because it got a toehold because it became Lincoln's house. And that really saved it, as you'll see. This is the East Room at a merrier occasion. It's the reception of General Grant, who's returned from Vicksburg, and his triumph there. And here's old General Scott. He's got gout so bad he can't stand up, sitting down there, so fat. And then President Lincoln and Mrs. Lincoln and the guest of honor, little General Grant, who was small. And sometimes these occasions were several thousand people. People would faint, it was so hot. But the rising Union triumph was taking place. Lincoln, within a short time's coffin, would be beneath that chandelier, having been assassinated. The Grants moved in 1869 he was to be the peacemaker. The war was over. The hero of the Union moved to the house. They had this picture painted of the ideal American family being themselves. It was hauled over in an ox cart the day after the inauguration and hung up in the Red Room so the public touring the house could see this typical American family and how happy they were and how great they were. It was widely published in prints for sale. Such is the way the White House has always been used. There are messages that it can help convey. Here's the East Room in Grant's time. Actually, it's in the summertime, and they've got slipcovers on paper. But it was a huge room, 85 feet long by 45 feet wide. And during some of the receptions at 4th of July, we get up to 6,000 people. And they would put steps up to the windows, hoping people would just get out. They quit serving anything. People weren't staying very long.
Where did the 6,000 people come from?
All over everywhere. I mean, they were hack drivers, they were newspaper editors, it was every sort of people that came in and shook the president's hand. Sometimes his hand would be blue. And you know, the day he signed Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, he was very particular about his hand. He didn't want it to be hurt, so it would tremble when he signed. But he shook 6,500 hands that day. And this one of the great rooms, I guess, in American history. It's always had three huge chandeliers. It wasn't finished till about 1830. And these were the second set of chandeliers. No, I'm sorry, the first set of chandeliers. There was one more that General Grant would put in after this for his daughter's wedding that took place in the room, and then the ones you see today.
Was it an issue about the amount of money that was being spent on furnishings?
Always. But you see, the government really puts up very little. every president was given $20,000 in administration. And back in those days, his salary was $25,000. And that $20,000 was to cover everything at the house. And in Lincoln's case, of course, his wife went out and started spending money, a lot of money. And it it created a problem for Lincoln, you know, when he finally saw the bills. And it was really a problem. It was always a problem, as it is today, getting furnishings and things for the house. It's not like a house in Europe that's furnished by the government. Now, this is the green room in Rutherford B. Hayes' day, just there to show you what it was like in its Victorian heyday. Very similar to how Lincoln did
it. What would it be used for?
Receiving. Lots of little conferences, you'd say. The president would speak with somebody at a party. That room originally had one door to it. And they would close the door and talk to their political people and that kind of thing. There are three parlors, you know, the red room, the blue room, and the green room. And this was the parlor usually that the president stayed in during reception.
Because it's right next to the East Room.
So right next to the East Room. Willie Lincoln's body was in there during his funeral, Lincoln's son. Here, President, I seem to be long on assassination. Here's President Garfield, whose wound was not as serious as President Reagan's. And here he is in his death agony that lasted several months. And Alexander Graham Bell has come to try to sound for the bullet that was in him, but the bed springs got in the way, and the sounding would never work. And so he developed gangrene. And when they took him to the beach, thinking he had rallied cowed, very suddenly died.
During that time, there was a reporter who stayed round the clock and stayed down in the telegraph room and then came down. There was a letter which you had in your book where the AP reporter was writing to his wife at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he was reporting on the president's health. And so he said that to see how the president was doing, he would walk down the hallway, the door was slightly ajar, he would listen for his breathing, and then he would report the president was still alive.
And he also said Mrs. Garfield lost all her hair. Remember that? Oh, she lost all of her hair during the time. Well, you know, this was taking place at the west end of the second floor, but the second floor was divided in two. And before 1902, the offices were all upstairs, too. So the telegraph room was at the other end of the hall, and there was this big corridor we'll see in a minute. And the family had seven rooms to live in. And the rest of the house was public downstairs, and then offices just crammed above.
So the office space is basically what's over the east room.
Yes, that's what they had. The ceilings are low. Of course, you notice the gas light fixtures. And
how many people would be working in, say, in that office area, the office space that's above the east room?
There were 16 office employees pretty regularly up until Cleveland. And then it began to jump. And they got to up to around 30 by McKinley. And they were just packed in there. And the light bulbs hanging all over the place. It's hard to believe it was in the same place.
Yeah. What occasioned the increases?
The pressure of business. For example, the president had long since ceased signing everything. Way back in the 1820s, James Jackson didn't sign everything. And then James K. Polk started the voucher system to try to cut down on paperwork. And it was I guess like in any business or office, just at certain intervals it becomes overpowering and you say, wait, let's reorganize. But there were just vast quantities of paper that would come to the president's office and then were sent out to the different departments, but they had to be reviewed in the president's office. So everybody who worked there had their own responsibility. First women to work in the office in the late 1880s. And from then on, there were always women there. But given the office situation, I'm not sure they wanted to be in there. It was very crowded, one little toilet in the back end of a room with a screen around it. And it was an acute situation in the office, but it's hard to change anything in the White House because everybody's in a hurry. You know, that clock starts going, and then the president moves in, and it's not going to stop for anything, and then just becomes a small matter to go through the trouble of it. And here's the entrance hall. Every business caller called here, and a guard took his card or a note from him and gave it to a messenger who ran up through that door on the left and ran up a little back stair, through the family quarters, down to the office, showed it to the secretary, and if the secretary, who was the second most powerful man in Washington, and if the secretary chose not to have this person see the president, the person was not going to see the president. But if they did, then they went up a stair that's out of the picture over here to your left, and they went up there. Now, in those days, the president held public hours, usually 2 hours a day during the week, and sometimes the line would go through out the front door for so many people. And you know, you're familiar with the famous Lincoln spoil system, people trying to come in to see him by the carload at various times. In 1889, there was a proposal to try to hoodwink the Congress in a way into celebrating the 100th anniversary of George Washington's inauguration by enlarging the White House. They'd already learned they couldn't tear it down. So this was what they were going to do. You see the old house in the middle with the portico added in 1824. These huge wings came out with guest rooms and all sorts of rooms, and then the grade drops in the back, so those greenhouses were below the grade. You could see the river over them. And it made a huge quadrangle in there.
And there was going to be space for the press.
Well, not in this one, but in the next one. There was a subsequent one in 1899 that had enormous quarters, including showers, for the press, and telephones and everything to really accommodate it. It was McKinley, who was very, very astute with the press.
And was that part of Carolyn Harrison?
That was Mrs. Harrison. She would have gotten by with it, but she died in 92.
It's interesting that a woman, the first lady, would be so involved.
She's one of the neglected, of all the first ladies, the most neglected. She was a very bright woman. She was one of the pioneers in the DAR, and she's the one of the ones that, being founded by working women, who wanted to use this ancestry business to show that they were just like other women, you know. And Caroline Harrison said, forget it, get political. And she held instructions in the blue room on politics because she was very good at it. All first ladies are good at that. And she is the one that put the DAR on the political track that it's remained on. And she's a very interesting woman. There are no biographies. There are papers. But she died of a Bright's disease, which was in the White House. This is the blue room. We don't need to linger on it, but this is the blue room in its Victorian heyday. It was painted robin's egg blue by Tiffany. And the ceiling was silver. And gave the effect of snowflakes falling down the walls. You imagine that didn't last too long.
The president, Tony Blair, had a press conference not so long ago, this past year, in which they were in Cross Hall in the blue room behind them.
Oh, really?
And so, yeah, you could see through to the blue room, and then in the very distance, you could see the
Jefferson. Roosevelt wanted that footprint when he wrote up. Here's the blue room 4 years later, after Theodore Roosevelt had remodeled the White House to suit a more modern presidency, building a modern office. The Congress gave more trouble over that office than anything. He said the president's moving out of the White House. So they called it the temporary executive office building for the longest time. And this room is very significant historically. When an ambassador or minister comes to the United States, almost all ambassadors now, they present their credentials in that room. Jefferson started, the one who killed all ceremonies, he started the most endearing one. The president stands in the middle of the room beneath the chandelier, and whichever chandelier it may be, and the ambassador enters with the secretary of state, and they read addresses to each other, and the president looks at his credentials, shakes hands, he becomes the official ambassador. Today, interestingly enough, thanks to TV and so forth, ambassadors come in, they have their pictures taken, they go through all this, then they say, with their families, would it be possible for us to have our pictures taken in the Oval Office? Because it's more famous now than the Blue Room. This is the upstairs study in Franklin D. Roosevelt's time, using the old desk. It's in Taft's time. That's the private study on the second floor. The president never totally gave up working in the White House, and has not today. He still has a study in the treaty room. They did away with all the decorations. This is 1909. This is the first Oval Office. It was built by Taft when he enlarged the Roosevelt West Wing, and he built it. It is on the Oval Office today. This was torn down in 1934 and replaced by the same one that's there today, which has not changed. This burned in 1929.
Was this in the same place?
Yes.
The Oval Office is today?
Yes, it is. The reason Taft did that and made it oval was because he wanted to identify with rooms in the House. People had said, oh, we don't want to meet, congressmen wouldn't want to meet in this place because it was like an outbuilding or something. So Taft thought by putting a building, a room that resembled the most famous room in the House, the Blue Room, that and it worked, created the office. Even he wouldn't sign bills in there. No bills were signed until Woodrow Wilson, who actually used it as an office.
Were there pictures of it, or did when people thought about coming to the White House, they still thought in terms of
going in the mansion? The mansion. And anybody in Congress thought he was important enough to go in the front door of the mansion, and they had created a new side entrance, which is where you would go if you went today. But everybody does today, but these officials thought they should go in the front door and go straight up to the open, to the president's office or study. They didn't like meeting here. But Taft was very shrewd in doing this because it did work.
And they still had the receptions. So, for example, Theodore Roosevelt had reception.
Oh, yes. You mean the public receptions?
The public receptions.
They stopped and didn't stop until 1929.
And how many people would come through?
6,000 or 8,000. They had gotten it to a fine point, but you couldn't bring automobiles into the grounds, and you literally went through. I mean, you went there in a bit, but you shook your hand and went. And the Hoovers did away with it. They did it the first year. 29 was their first year. And 30, he went fishing. And then when the Roosevelts came in, Franklin D. Roosevelt wanted to start it up again. And it was such a nightmare. He said, never again. He goes to Hyde Park. And they did it once. It was too many people and too much handshaking and the Secret Service going bananas, you know, with all this. And
what about the other times that the president had where he would meet with members of Congress, meet with important people, you know, just citizens who were coming through, who were going to present their credentials to the secretary, just basically the chief of staff today.
Right.
How long did those last?
You mean those daily?
Yes, things? Daily sessions.
Probably FDR depression period, and I think they still lingered. You still had groups of Boy Scouts coming in, people like that.
Which you do today as well.
And sometimes they would go to the East Room and then meet somebody or sit with them a while and have their picture taken. And exact same way royalty did in Europe.
But they did away with the hours, like 2 hours a day, say,
yes. Theodore Roosevelt didn't do that. Not that dressy away. I think the separation of office and residence helped in that.
How did the Congress view the building of the West Wing, the temporary office space?
They didn't like it. I mean, they didn't want it done at all. They thought the president should stay in the White House. Because remember, there's this whole history before this of people trying to tear the White House down. President Arthur tried to tear it down. President Andrew Johnson tried to tear it down and build a presidential palace. I've been looking for the drawings for 20 years. If you ever find them, come see me. But this house that was drawn to be in Rock Creek Park, and Congress just, no, no, no. And then suddenly the president wants to live out in an outbuilding or in a wing. And they didn't like it. Like you wanted to, but it had to be. But there was a press room in the new plan and facilities for that. And the president, it was called not the president's office, but the president's room. It never became the office till the Oval Office. And the Oval Office was never called that until the end of the Kennedy administration, and then not much. And it really got in, I guess, under Johnson. Just called the president's office. Well, here's some work going on in the White House in 1948. President Harry Truman had trouble with chandeliers swinging when they shouldn't have been, and plaster filtering down, and his daughter's piano leg went through the floor, and they moved out, and they moved to Blair House, and the house was remodeled, as he liked to say. But look at this next one. They really skinned it. They had to. It was a fire trap. The inner structure was so much wood that one fire bomb or Coke bottle could have set it on fire. So they skinned it entirely. They went 3 stories underground. They changed everything and made a house of about 60 rooms into a house of 134 rooms. And then by using steel, as you see, they didn't have to use the heavy brick backing of the stone. So they got space for air conditioning ducts and all that kind of thing. And every room was air conditioned and heated separately from every other one. And the air could be tested every hour for poison, all sorts of things. And this structure you see in the middle, it makes sort of a rectangle or whatever, that's still there. That's how they emptied the house. They built that thing through the floors and the walls down into the sub-basement before there was such. Mm-hmm. And they pulled all the contents of the house, the innards of the house, out through that, up through the window and out those chutes that you saw. And that's how they cleaned it out. And they rebuilt the White House inside.
Where did it go? All those
unfortunately, some were saved, some things were saved, mantles were saved, some doors were saved. Most of it was landfilled in Fort Myer to create the playground, the sports ground there now. I just wanted to show an artifact. The White House, for all the fact that it's more or less new inside, 50 years old, has artifacts everywhere. This was bought in 1818 by James Monroe, and it's still used all the time. The plateau in the middle of the dining room table. There's Washington's portrait that we started out with, looking from the green room into the east room, where it was first hung in 1929, having always been in the red room. This is the entrance hall. Now talk about presenting people to the public. This staircase is the photo op staircase. That never existed that way. That was a wall there. And President Truman, when the house was rebuilt, said he could not stand having his picture taken while he was going down a long stair. You know, he was a very natty dresser. Probably the nattiest in the history of the entire White House. And he didn't like it. So they went through more drawings than you could imagine, dozens of them, and finally came up with this idea, where when the president entered, at a state occasion, they play Hail to the Chief, he and his party come down the steps, and then they all stand there, which you've seen in the newspapers before, and have their picture taken. And it was something created for a photo opportunity that's still used today. Here's the cross hall, which President Bush has made a lot of use of. There's the Steinway piano in the East Room. And he stands in the East Room, and you see the hall. And, of course, there's the classic picture of him after the Iraq business, where he's leaving, having made a speech, and he's going down the hall, and they catch him from way up high. That's a very good picture. The green room today. The blue room, as the Clintons redid it. Mrs. Clinton took a great personal interest in it.
What would it be used for today?
The reception rooms. They have party after party after party, and some of them they don't pay for. Institutions pay for them that they support, and they all handle it very nicely. You get great food and drinks and things, and just walk around in the rooms just like you're at home and sit on the furniture and everything else. And they have social aides, however, that are young military people, and you better behave. They're past masters at getting people out of there who had too much to drink. You don't even know they went. And they watch it pretty well. But this is, of course, the Red Room. And just another of the parlors with anti-American furniture. The state dining room, which will seat 110, used to seat 60 until they enlarged it, where Theodore Roosevelt enlarged it. And they try every way in the world to get more people seated in there and have lots of trouble with it. Sometimes they use round tables. They used to use horseshoe tables. But it's probably, we'll seat only so many. Here it is for a party with the round tables and the little smaller chairs. Henry Kissinger sat in one and fell flat on the ground. The legs went out from under him. Here's the family dining room on the main floor. Just what it is. And one thing, up until the Kennedy administration, there were real candles in that light fixture, the only one in the house, and they would burn real candles. They're apparently quite beautiful. The East Room today, with the piano, and the third set of chandeliers ever in there, Washington's portrait.
When did those chandeliers
come in? 1902. And they were remodeled a little, because everybody needs more and more and more light, than they used to. And they've got spotlights in them and indirects in them and everything in the world. And they were made in New York by Caldwell and Company, the top of the line. Here is the second floor transverse hall or cross hall. Let's linger on this a second. The house has, on each floor, these long halls that run crossways to the plant. And upstairs, this was a corridor always. And that door you see down there had ground glass doors in it. And that went into the office in Lincoln's time and late 19th century. This was taken in 1902 by Roosevelt as part of the house. It never was used a lot, but today it's really used. There's a three living, it's divided into three parts, as it always was, but there's three living rooms. And if you go in the east end, by the east room, you have to go up, they now have it ramped, but you used to go up 3 steps because the east room ceiling was higher than the others. And I think that irregularity came from Washington, from the commission's cutting the size of the house down. I think they were all had ceilings like that, but the rooms were too small for that. It has 22-foot ceilings. The rest of them are 18 feet. But the bedrooms are open off of that, the sitting room. Here's the most famous bedroom, the Lincoln bedroom. It contains the bed that Lincoln couldn't stand, that Mary Lincoln bought and spent money when he said we could have been buying blankets for our soldiers. That's the room that's supposed to have ghosts. Here's the cabinet room, designed in 1934 for President Roosevelt when he enormously enlarged the wing using... Herbert Hoover had planned to do that, and the Depression stopped it, and Roosevelt, that they couldn't function with it the way it was. The Oval Office decorated for George Bush, the first President Bush. Decorated for President Clinton. And here's the White House from the air. I show you this because here's your old house in the middle. There are Jefferson's wings. Theodore Roosevelt's office on the left, the West Wing as it developed. On the right was built during World War II, secretly, with a bomb shelter under it, and the word never got out. Never one word about it, not one workman said a thing. But you have the original house, and the original executive offices were all in the yard. Those two huge buildings, the double hull in the middle one there, and the huge castle-looking one on the left, those are only the third buildings on their sites. That's where the departments, war, navy, and all that were, post office. They're only the third on their sites. To the right is Treasury, begun in 1833. And on the left is a state, war, and navy, which combined 3 departments. It was considered the biggest office building anywhere. And of course, they're obsolete now. But notice the angle of the streets, 16th Street down Meridian Hill. This is the original plan laid out by George Washington in the days when the city was young. Everything full of stumps and old fields and so forth. This is how it's developed, and there it has remained. That's the last of the pictures I have.
Well, that is that's very interesting. Looking to it, its development, you can see publicity was a factor.
Always.
Always. What kind of continuities do you see in presidents and their dealings with reporters? During all of
that time period,
did presidents regularly deal with reporters, and how did they deal with that press?
Well, I think it depends on the man. McKinley was a master, of course, and then he had a good press man who became ill and died, and then George Cortelyou came forward, who was a real master, one of the most interesting people in all history of anything. I mean, he went from secretary to being holding 2 cabinet positions, came in with a specimen shorthand. That's how he got to the White House. Then, I think Lamon, what was
Dan
his name?
Lamon.
Dan Lamon.
Dan.
I think Dan Lamon with Cleveland. Cleveland kind of was a big, mean guy, you know, and he could get mad at the press. He called them mules and slobs and everything. And he had Dan Lamon. He was a very cool-headed, clever man. And you know the story about Cleveland, who got in the second administration. You know, Cleveland was elected one, and then he was defeated, and then he came back for another, the only one in history. He got cancer in the roof of his mouth. Was it Hathaway? Mm-hmm. It was terrible. And it was a depression time, and they were afraid the public opinion, the morale would go. So he went on a boat out from Massachusetts to sea, and they tied him down and gave him laughing gas, of all things. And they cut that out of the top of his mouth and put a rubber filler into it. And he was, you know, could not be handled. They got him back to the house. He goes out on the front porch in his pajamas, you know, his face wrapped up in bandages. And so the press caught on to it. The press were all out on the edge. And Dan Lamon gathered them all in the barn and talked them out of reporting it. And it was never reported until his death. It's the most sensational scoop of the world. And they just... But Lamon was fabulous. He was later a cabinet member and all. But he had these good people for a year, didn't he?
Were there staff people, we'll say, before the Civil War? Were there times when when staff people regularly dealt with the press, or did the president mostly deal with reporters?
I think president very often, and I think it was a very friendly thing. Mm-hmm. But one person that has never been approached from this point of view, but was a journalist, was, of course, George Lincoln's secretary. We're so good. No, Nahay and... Anyway, Hay and Nicolay, George Nicolay, a Belgian, he was a newspaper man that Lincoln brought in early in Illinois before he was even elected. And the extent of his dealings, who knows? The newspaper people moved in and out. They went into the office. They were around all the time. They had messengers to head to the telegraph office because they weren't allowed to use the White House office. And in later years, in the later 19th century, the messengers' bicycles would be lined up on the driveway. And each group or man, a person, had a messenger, and they'd give that scoop to the messenger who would run it to the telegraph office and down on Pennsylvania Avenue and telegraph it into their papers. And that went on for a long time.
L.A. Gobright, who was the first bureau chief of Associated Press, in his recollections of men and things in Washington, talked about going to see Lincoln. There was a report that they had heard about a battle during the war. And so he said, on one occasion, an important telegram was received at the War Department announcing a grand Union victory. But for some reason, unexplained at the time, the secretary was not disposed to communicate the particulars. Failing thus to attempt to obtain them at the department, several of the correspondents hastened to the executive mansion in order to secure the desired information from the president. The cabinet meeting had just adjourned, and several of the members were leaving the room. The representatives of the press had no sooner sent in their cards to him than he welcomed them in a loud voice. Walk in, be seated, take seats. And before they had time to announce the object of their visit, he remarked, I know what you have come for. You want to hear more about the good news. And so they felt that they could regularly go in and see the president. So in a sense, at that time, there were no beats. Mm-hmm. Reporters could go from one to another. So Gobright would go up to the White House, but he'd also go up to the Hill and to the departments as mm-hmm. well. What feeling did reporters have about their right to cover a president, and what right they had to be in the House, in the executive mansion?
My impression is they were kept very much at bay. You know, they couldn't directly quote the president without his permission.
Yeah.
And they were prohibited from that from the start. And I think they were on sacred ground. They treated it very carefully because of the august man. I mean, they were more connected with the man. But, you know, everything was more open. President Benjamin Harrison used to go down to the East Room every day for an hour. And anybody who came in, he'd shake hands with him, kiss babies and all that stuff. And I think it was just a more fluid relationship then, which became impossible. But they wanted a story, but there were devices to keep them away from that, and they could be kept out.
Uh-huh. One of the people that you write about in the President's House who clearly had an idea that the president was a fair game in his house, and the social events were something that the public had a right to know about, was Emily Briggs, who wrote under the name Olivia. And in one of her letters that were published under the name of Olivia, she talked about the right that the public had to know. And there's some distinctions in her mind. And she does a lot of color reporting, in a sense, and a lot of social reporting. And she said that card receptions, such as are held at the homes of the cabinet, Chief Justice Chase, and General Sherman, in a certain sense, are veiled under the sacred seal of hospitality. And the newspaper correspondent dare not, cannot, without violating all delicacy and good taste, make a pen picture of the men and women whom the dear people at home like to know about. A presidential levee is altogether a different affair. It is public. It belongs to the people. When we go to the executive mansion, we go to our own house. Our sacred feet press our own tufted Wilsons. We recline on our own satin and ebony. We are received graciously by our own well-dressed servants and the people have a right to know through the columns of the press the exact state of the situation. And you can see that view then gradually takes hold by reporters, although the president and his staff voice are regarding their lives as something that they should decide what is being reported. But you could see back there, they did have that kind of tussle. So it's really in Cleveland's administration that we get staff that are particularly attuned to a press meeting. And in part, it would seem that it's because there's such a demand for information about the president. And if the president is not going to provide the information, somebody has to do it. And it's a recognition of hiring people like Lamont, and also in Harrison, Elijah Halford, who had a background in the press as well. And then continually, it seems that the secretary, who is analogous to the chief of staff, has that kind of background, like John Addison Porter for McKinley also had that background. And then Cordelier, while he didn't, he certainly was the master of publicity.
Seemed to be able to do anything. And they published little directives, little books about how you did, what the press could and couldn't do, what everybody could and couldn't do who worked in the White House. You were told exactly what to wear, when to wear it. If you worked in the office, your desk was to be absolutely clean when you got up to leave. And there was even a little booklet of how to act when you rode horseback with the president. You were not to ever let your stirrup go ahead of his. And only one at a time could ride with him. And when he nodded, you were to fall back so the next person could come up and talk to the press. I think under Teddy Roosevelt, he was so wild, you know, they had to have some rules. I know his wife wanted some of those.
When they moved to the West Wing and the press had its own room, and before that they actually had space in 1896. William Price was
in the
reporter,
hall.
Yeah, talked about having that desk, having that table in the hallway. They developed tacit understandings. When the president walked by, they were not allowed to talk to him, but he could talk to them, and then they would respond. But
That's still pretty true around the house, within the White House.
Uh-huh.
You don't address the president unless he addresses you.
Well, with a newspaper report, yeah. I'd say with reporters, though, they don't see him walking generally down the hallway. They seem to be able to keep them away.
It must be Mrs. Woodrow Wilson the first who stopped that, started that, because she created a separate entrance to the West Wing.
Uh-huh.
Did not go through the where everyone else was. President's walks.
In the area that the staff had, the people that were, we'll say the ones that were above the East Room, when they had space in the West Wing, how many people in, say, in 1902 when they moved in, how many staff people were there?
Oh, you mean of the president's staff?
Yes.
About 30.
Uh-huh.
In all. And you went in a big hallway with the guards there, and there was a cross hallway behind it with the doors into the secretary's office. You see, when the wing was built, it was the secretary who was on the main axis. He was the important one that the wing was there for. The president had a work room. And then, as Taft remodeled it, the president had an important room too. But it was originally a staff, the staff was it. Then on your right was the press room, which I don't think it held over about, it had about 12 desks,
mm-hmm.
with telephones,
mm-hmm.
and there was telegram.
Uh-huh.
And then there were waiting rooms on the other side, and then other staff.
And then there was staff room that was kind of behind where the press room
behind
was.
Behind the press.
Were reporters able to go and talk to those staff people?
No. They were not to talk to any reporters or ever say anything without permission from the secretary.
Mm-hmm.
They could release no news, could give no details of anything. That's in their little booklet.
Uh-huh. So that in a way there's a continuity there.
Yeah.
In that, no matter whether it's a Democrat or Republican.
You know, in this period they were already destroying typewriter ribbons.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize that. I was working on some State Department stuff. Typewriter ribbons were taken at the end of the day and destroyed officially, formally,
uh-huh.
because of, you know, someone could get a hold of them.
Were they worried, who were they worried might get a hold of?
I don't know, in that period, in the 90s, but Spanish-American War, I guess, and there were spies, there were problems with that, all over the place. And more, I think, you go in State Department records, it's practically a spy store. They're everywhere, every little coastal town you ever heard of, and everywhere, as it goes up toward the war, but Spanish War and all. And I think they were highly aware of that. I don't think any of this is so terribly new today. It's just more technical, more broadcast.
When did the White House take on a persona where it will say in the news, the White House said today?
Oh, that comes with television. President Truman, when he did the White House in, or got it, he restored it the way he did so it would last as the home of the president. He had a choice, make it into a museum or build another place. He said, no, it has such symbolic power. Lincoln lived there, Washington built it. So he had those walls saved that George Washington had put there. And so he already realized the power of television, living across the street. When he gave interviews that happened to be televised, it was right at the end of his administration, there weren't many. Always wanted the White House in the background, and it was. And then, when the job was finished on the restoration, there was a broadcast room, a huge 40-foot-long room. But it was outdated before it was finished. It was beneath the entrance hall in the old kitchen. It was a nice, handsome room with a desk for the president and where the radio, you know, and all could be. And it was all set up. Well, then Eisenhower used that room. He became concerned about television and his advisors, and they hired the great television pioneer, Robert Montgomery, who came in and did everything he could to make Eisenhower not camera shy. They'd do everything. They put up a wall and painted it black and put little holes in it and peepholes for the cameraman to photograph him while he talked. All kinds of experiments. The most difficult being when they had to make him convince him that he had to powder his head so it wouldn't shine in the lights. So according to Robert Montgomery, he didn't like that. But there was a lot going on until the Kennedy administration came in, which had been working on PR long before the presidency. You know, that new book, Jack, you all seen that, the picture book on the market, the timeline did? It's the work of a single photographer that had already started in 56 or 7, photographing the members of the Kennedy family and President Kennedy in an almost theatrical way, you know, glamour pictures. Yeah. And with the books about it, I was so astonished to see that it started so long before. Of course, it becomes more and more professionalized. But, after all, Andrew Jackson, who was as scrawny as a scarecrow, and he had a old bullet in him with lead that was killing him. He and Thomas R. Benton had got shot at each other one time, and he got this ball in him. He got his arm, fortunately, Benton got shot in the behind, but came out better. And so Jackson, they fixed the arch into the East Room. The East Room was finished for him, and they had 150, it's in the bill, 155 big gold relief stars they pasted on the wallpaper above the arch. And then the band would play, and Jackson would come with his hair brushed back and this cape they had made, a cloak with brass buttons out wide to make him look bigger, and a big collar. And he would sweep into the East Room. You know, it was a performance. You know, which I'm sure he had done many before, but they've all done that sort of thing. President Taft weighed over 300 pounds, but he was kind of tall, but he's a great big man. And he didn't like marching down the stairs to hail to the chief. Theodore Roosevelt loved it. There used to be about 30 people, two by two, and the trumpets playing, and the gates would be opened, and he had presented. But Taft was embarrassed and came down the elevator because he thought he looked foolish. They've always been presenting themselves.
Wonderful backdrop, yeah, for presidents from Adams Ford who lived there.
But that unseen audience is another matter, and I think that starts, the unseen visual audience, starts, yeah, really with President Truman. I mean, I think he was very perceptive about that.
And then Eisenhower really, though he may not have liked it, really was the first television president, because he's the first president to have press conferences that are televised. He's the first president to have on-the-record press conferences.
And Roosevelt it was such a difficult matter with him because they had to be very careful in the presentation because of his handicap. Mm-hmm. And those locked braces and all. So the fireside chats, they were radio. You know, you did can see a crackling fireplace, like with Jimmy Carter in his sweater. You saw, you just heard it. In fact, it wasn't even by a real fireplace.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if we can go and have some questions now from Towson. Are there people who would like to ask questions of Dr. Seal? Mike?
It's the question that comes right.
Okay.
You had mentioned earlier that gatherings outside the White House were very peaceful gatherings. I was wondering if there were many protests outside the White House, or did that usually take place farther away?
No, the protests start strangely late. And with the White House. Now, the hanging the president effigy is the only one I really know of before later, turn of the century. Wilcoxey's army, when was that?
That's
97.
That's under
Cleveland. Anyway, it was that. They camped out there, and then we're given a camp to go to. There wasn't much, really. I'd say it's not an issue much till the 20th century.
Uh-huh.
You have the suffragettes who were out there. And
is it because the presidency becomes more important, as seeing that the president is going to be one who is going to be pressing for legislation? And so it comes about that time.
The president becomes the button, the push
yes,
button.
Right.
I also suspect it's because more eyes are on the White House. Because if you have a demonstration, somebody got to see it. So you're assuming that the world's going to see this and be impressed by it. And I would think that the illustrated press would show these people, like they were doing in London. Of course, that was already well underway.
Uh-huh. So in a way, it's getting into his picture.
Yeah.
That you know he's
exactly.
going to have the space. So
it's an interesting question because today, with the closing of Pennsylvania Avenue, the Secret Service would love to close Lafayette Park and that whole area and make it all just pedestrian area and be able to lock it when they close it because of terrorism. And there's just terrible protests, not public, but within the system and the debating within the system. That's not right. That's not right. It's the citizens' right to go there, and if they protest or sleep on a park bench or whatever they do, it belongs to the American people. Now, that is not a 19th century idea. I mean, in the original plan, that was just the front yard of the White House. I mean, in the 20s, that wasn't around in Lincoln's time, I don't think, except they did used to come there, and it was fenced, though. It was locked at night in Lincoln's time. And that is an attitude today, and it's been one of the hardest parts of the deliberations over how to rethink and recast, which has to be done. It's been done, as you know, from tonight all through the history of the White House. There's been a rethinking, so it works better. And that's a definite factor in the planning of how to permanently, at least for the next 30 years, fix the area around the White House. But terrorism, of course, is a tremendous issue in bombing after Oklahoma City. So the two ideas are fighting within the same group. It's not opposing groups, it's opposing philosophies within the same. And an interesting second.
Were there, we've seen a lot of pictures of protests during the Vietnam War, protests, the March on Washington, which was one of the biggest marches. It was the first big march, really, in the latter part of the 20th century. There had been some discussion of having one, A. Philip Randolph, who was the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, who said during the Roosevelt administration had threatened to have a march over a Fair Employment Practices Commission. But that didn't take place, and there were no really big demonstrations until 1963. But in the March on Washington, but the march did not come to the White House. The march was really on Capitol Hill, and the rallying points were the Lincoln Memorial and then in the Capitol. It really didn't go go by the White House, although Kennedy understood how important it was, and then he asked the leaders, Martin Luther King and the others, to come to the White House. But following that, the protests against the war, against the Vietnam War, they certainly were centered. The first one, I think, was the Pentagon, but after that, they focused on the White House. Now it seems to be certainly a center of a natural center of protest. Other questions?
You mentioned a 1999 design for the House restroom that would be one of the instruments that exist now. The voters realize how incredibly prominent it would become.
That 1899 design for a press room. That was that Theodore Bingham's plan, or is that?
Yes, but it was to please Bingham, to please the president. Mm-hmm. He wanted a facility for the press where they could be around. Uh-huh. And that's, Bingham was trying to sell the idea and trying to get the Kennedys to agree.
Uh-huh. What happened to that plan generally?
Well, it probably never would have happened because Mrs. McKinley, after she went to the presentation, they were pushing her wheelchair out of the room. No one was paying any attention to her, and the guy was pushing her. She said, "Well, it's all very nice, but it's not going to be any hammering while I'm with here." Well, that was pretty much it. So that one fell by the wayside.
Uh-huh.
But it was planned, and most of the drawings wasn't done in great detail. But there was definitely a press room with all sorts of facilities, and the press wing.
And McKinley, on one of the trips that McKinley took to North Carolina, he went to Asheville, and the place where he was going, they didn't want reporters to come in. And so he said that he wasn't going to go in if reporters weren't allowed.
Oh.
And that won him a lot of favor with reporters.
He's very clever.
Yeah. He was. He took a trip to the West Coast in 1901. Which was an 8-week trip, and they had the Cordelier in his files talks about, and they had a very large contingent of press, and one of the things that he was trying to do was develop a dark room on the train so they could take photographers with them, and I think they ended up doing that.
Because they had a press car.
Yeah. But even if they didn't have I think that plan was a lot larger than the West Wing ended up being.
It's huge.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So
the West Wing had to be in scale with the White House because Theodore Roosevelt's interest was in the historic house. And he saw it as a setting, I think, but he also was interested in it. And that's the only reason he ever gave any support to the Macmillan plan, because he called for preserving the White House. The architects would love to have torn it down. But he wouldn't hear of it. And the only remark he made about the Macmillan plan when he was shown it was, "Well, I'm glad you're preserving the White House." Mm-hmm. That's what he was interested in. Unlike Taft.
Do we have any questions here? Stephanie?
You know, what impact do you think this visual impact of the West Wing television show has been in sort of popularizing further the image of the West Wing and the White House?
It's strangely believable. But of course, it makes a drama out of everyday work. And I don't know. I it's hard for me to say. It's been very popular.
It has. It certainly
it's a fantasy view.
When a lot of people watch it, and when I speak, people always want to know if that's the way that the West Wing actually works. And so they tend to think of it in those kinds of terms. And but I noticed that they fell off somewhat during the Bush years. I guess starting in about 2002, their viewership dropped. And I wondered if it was because they had captured something that was in the Clinton years, because they came in and talked to people and saw how things were. And I wondered if they thought that they had somehow gotten away from how the West Wing operated under the Bush administration. Trying to rework it some. And they do have Republicans as well as Democrats on their staff, their writing staff. Yeah.
It's interesting, the role of the press is highly emphasized in the television series.
One of the things that's interesting when you look at the press over time, that they've gotten space, but when Cordelier was writing all those instructions, he said that he didn't want them hanging around the north portico because they had space upstairs outside in that lobby, and they didn't like having them outside. The reporters always want to waylay the guests of the president and talk to them. And even today, with the West Wing there, that you notice that right between the West Wing and the area that is going to be, it's the press area, the press room where the briefing takes place, there are a group of microphones, and that's a stakeout, which is where members of Congress come to speak after they talk to the president. So in many ways, there are things that have changed. They have orders that they didn't have, but they still are using some of the same methods, and they still want to see those guests of the president.
But if a congressman doesn't want to talk to them, he leaves another way.
Right. There are a lot of ways out. Yeah.
Yeah.
And in different ways in. Yeah, they're difficult. Reporters generally come in the northwest gate, and then the president's visitors come in the southwest gate. There are always reporters that are trying to see what's going on in the southwest gate to see who is coming in. Any other questions at Towson?
You had mentioned earlier that security was a primary reason for making alterations to the White House, such as putting up trees and fences, things of that sort. Do you see the events of 9/11 maybe possibly leading to future alterations to the White House necessary?
No question. I'm not sure it's going to be to the house or the grounds within the fence, but it's going to be around it, the streets around it. I think more and more vehicular traffic is going to be taken off the streets, more and more. So you can't drive trucks up. You know, when President Truman finished the White House, it was bomb-proof. It was considered state-of-the-art bomb-proof. Every room is a steel cage. The bomb went off in the blue room, it would just blow up the blue room in those days. But today, a pickup truck with the right mixture in it, if it got close enough and had the time, knocked the thing over. So this is what they're continuing with in their replanning process.
And it certainly has within the building itself, because it had always been that open from Jefferson Ford, as you said. It's been a public house, and it was closed off with no public visitors for a good period of time after September 11th. And now, that when visitors do come through, it is a process that has to go through members of Congress, and the people are screened, and generally it's for young people to come. And then they've had military people come through, too.
And it's much regretted at the White House,
yeah,
because it was just an old tradition of going through, mm-hmm, but it's a practical matter, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much.
Enjoy.
Thank you. Thanks.